This podcast was recorded at the 2018 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference in Hollywood, Florida. To review the CE information and learn how to earn credit for JADPRO Live podcast activities, see the presentation material, or seek other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
Well, welcome back, everyone. My name is Carolyn Grandy, and I'm a nurse practitioner from the Abramson Cancer Center. I am also the chair of the Education Committee for AppShow and serve on the planning group for this conference. Before we begin, may I remind you to please silence your cell phones for our next lecture. We are delighted to have our next speakers join us. Please welcome Dr. Mary Ann Davies of the Yale University School of Nursing and Medicine and Ms. Beth Eby Sandy of the Abramson Cancer Center as they discuss the management of side effects for patients receiving multimodality therapy in thoracic oncology.
Great. Thank you all for joining us, and we're happy to be here for the second to last session for today. And Beth and I are going to be discussing management of side effects of patients receiving multimodality treatment in thoracic oncology. But in order for us to set the scene, we're actually going to be giving you a little background on the state of affairs in terms of lung cancer right now. So our learning objectives are to identify strategies to mitigate adverse events of checkpoint inhibitors in particular, evaluate emerging data regarding the management of AEs in EGFR and ALK inhibitors, and then also begin to have a discussion about formulating plans to mitigate AEs associated with radiotherapy. And these are our financial disclosures. So Beth will start us off.
Yeah, so I'm just going to do a brief overview of lung cancer, and then we're going to talk about locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer because there's a little bit that has changed in that field. So the scope of the problem, I probably don't have to tell most of you. Lung cancer is the second most commonly diagnosed cancer in men next to prostate cancer and the second most common in women next to breast cancer. However, if you take into the death rate and the perspective, lung cancer per year kills 154,000 people. That's more than breast, prostate, and colon combined annually. So as you can imagine, it's a common cancer, second most commonly diagnosed, but it's also very deadly. And because of that reason, our patients are on treatment constantly, right, Marianne, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
It's not like they're having treatment breaks frequently. They're on treatment for metastatic disease almost all the time. So histology matters in lung cancer. So, you know, we used to see that it was like 50-50 between adenocarcinoma and squamous. But when we talk about non-small cell lung cancer, adenocarcinoma is by far the most common type in the United States, 62%, and then followed by about 20% squamous. Small cell is that very aggressive type that it makes up about 13%, and that number is shrinking, and then 5% is a mixture of kind of everything else. But that does guide our therapy based on the histology. If you look at the stages in survival, you can see most people, unfortunately, are diagnosed at a distant stage. So 57% will have metastatic disease, but then another 22% will have what they say here is regional, but that's stage three, which is also very aggressive and only has about a 15% five-year survival rate. So quick math in my head, 79% of these are usually going to be advanced and require lifelong treatment. So let's pause and talk about stage three for just a minute. So what is stage three lung cancer? Stage three lung cancer means that you have a tumor, let's say on one side of your chest, and that the lymph nodes have spread into the mediastinum, or those centralized area. So not the hilar nodes, which are adjacent to the tumor, but they've spread into that middle or mediastinal area of the chest. A stage 3A means that they're on the ipsilateral side, or the same side of the tumor. Contralateral is a stage 3B, which means that the mediastinal nodes on the other side of the mediastinum. It's crossed over the mediastinum is a stage 3B. And then there's a new stage 3C, which is a satellite nodule in a different lobe of the same lung. There's various other things that can make you a stage three when we look into tumor size, but that's in general what we're seeing. So, like I was saying, the five-year survival rate is not great, even with treatment for stage three lung cancer. I took a look at kind of some of the hallmark studies The CALGB 39801 was an old study with paclitaxel and carboplatin plus radiation, common regimen that we use. Across studies, it's anywhere between 4 and 19%. And the reason I put five-year survival rates is because these are kind of the cure rates. In lung cancer, if you can go 5 years without your cancer coming back, we generally consider that a cure rate. It's rare that it would come back after that. And then the other common regimen seen in locally advanced disease, or stage three, is etoposide, cisplatin, and radiation. This is given day 1 through 5, and then with cisplatin on day 8 again. And that had a little bit better survival, depending on the study that you looked at, somewhere between 15 and one looking even at 29% five-year survival rate. A large meta-analysis looking at all the stage three chemo-rad studies for lung cancer said it's about 15% is the average survival rate, five-year survival rate. So, 85% of these people are unfortunately going to die of their disease and have recurrence. So about 30% of patients are diagnosed in this stage. The standard of care is chemo radiation. You can do surgery. However, that is a little bit decreased now since I've been doing lung cancer for 15 years. We used to operate more on these patients, but the morbidity and mortality associated with pretty large surgeries for stage three lung cancer has somewhat gone by the wayside. And especially because concurrent chemo radiation gives them just about as good and sometimes better survival rates than what we've seen surgically. So a lot of these patients will go to chemo radiation. Unfortunately, the median progression-free survival, so how long does it take your cancer to come back? 8 to 10 months after treatment. So that's obviously terrible. I show the three common regimens that we tend to use, some of which I've already talked about. And now there's new data of adding immunotherapy. So let's talk about that. So this is a trial of durvalumab post-chemo radiation. So these patients had chemo radiation with one of those regimens that I talked about, platinum plus another drug, concurrent with radiation. And for those patients who did not progress, and most don't, it is a very poor prognosis if your cancer grows while on chemo radiation. And for those of those who did not progress, they were randomized to either get durvalumab at 10 milligrams per kilogram every 2 weeks for 12 months versus placebo. And what we found here was that there was not only a significant improvement in the progression-free survival, so if you look, it's my left, so I'm guessing it's your left as well, you'll see that's the progression-free survival, significant improvement over placebo. And then the overall survival just came out very recently, showing that we are saving more lives than not. And it, actually, the median hasn't been reached. You see NR means not reached. So the median survival, about 28 months for the placebo arm, but the overall survival not reached yet. And that's really encouraging to me, meaning that by giving this for a year after chemo radiation, it appears that we are definitely saving lives. We'll really look out for that five-year survival rate when that comes out. And we've significantly prolonged progression. You can see 16 months versus, I think it's around 6 months on there. So what are the toxicities from chemo radiation? I think you guys know these pretty well. Not much has changed in this in the past 15 years, except I would say that there's probably less esophagitis. Would you say that, Marianne?
Well, I think with more focused radiation and SBRT that we'll see less of that.
Yeah, and proton radiation as well, which we do at Penn. I think we see definitely less esophagitis and less skin burns as well. The pancytopenias, we're really not going to change that. Chemotherapy is going to do its thing. Nausea, fatigue, radiation, pneumonitis. But again, they vary depending on what radiation technique the patient's getting, the patient themselves and what their comorbidities are, and what is the concurrent chemo radiation regimen you used. So it was interesting, when that durvalumab study came out, we were all like, oh my goodness, we're going to give everybody pneumonitis, because Marianne's going to talk about the side effects of immunotherapies, but one of them is inflammation of the lungs, pneumonitis, that's induced by immunotherapy. So we thought, okay, you just blasted somebody's lungs with radiation, damaged them, and now we're going to give them immunotherapy. We very much awaited this toxicity data, and as you can see here, it really wasn't much different from the placebo arm. You can see all grade of pneumonitis in the durvalumab arm was 33.9% versus 24.8%. But if you look at severe, grade 3-4, meaning had to discontinue the durvalumab, was 3.4% versus 2.6%. So not a huge difference. We were not significantly causing harm to these patients by giving them the immunotherapy. So our management strategies, again, haven't changed much for everything else. Esophagitis, supportive care. Unfortunately, most of the pharmacologic stuff doesn't work very well. I could yammer on about Malgic mouthwash, but we all know, especially with lung cancer patients, it's really hard to get something topical. They're getting radiated here, not here. So to get something topical down to that esophagus is really difficult. Obviously, the pancytopenias, we're not going to change much either. We can't give growth support, GCSF, for patients who are on radiation because there's an interaction there, especially for lung radiation. So we can't give the supportive drugs to keep the white count up. Skin burns, mostly topical preps. But like I said, those have been less with the newer radiation techniques we have. Nausea is a whole other ballgame, and there's a lot of good medication right now to prevent CINV, and just being on top of that and using the proper prophylaxis. And then radiation pneumonitis, just know what to look for. I'm going to do a slide on pneumonitis when we talk about the targeted therapies, so we'll talk a little bit about that. But I'm going to switch it over now to Marianne to talk, give you an overview of advanced non-small cell lung cancer.
Okay, so as Beth introduced, the histology is the first thing that we look at with non-small cell lung cancer, and that's what we're focusing on today. But also molecular driver mutations are of critical importance for our patients, and we're going to highlight what those mutations are. Standardly, they've been EGFR, ALK, ROS, BRAF, and now we're monitoring patients for PD-L1 expression, and all of those should be really reflex testing in most facilities. In the past, our considerations were that we should always consider doing molecular testing, particularly in patients that are never smokers and those with mixed histologies, but you'll see as we go on that we probably need to think about doing these reflex in all of our patients. This is a fairly recent slide of all of the driver mutations that we have in non-small cell lung cancer, and you can see that the largest driver is KRAS. Unfortunately, at this particular time, we do not have targeted therapies to KRAS, and 36% of our patients do not have an identifiable oncogenic driver. EGFR was one of the first ones that we identified that makes up about 17%, followed by ALK, and then there are several others that make up the platform for molecular drivers for this population. So we'll start with EGFR. So EGFR makes up about 20% of our lung cancers. It occurs more in men than in women, more common in Asians than Caucasians, more common in never smokers, and so that's why we target the never smokers always when it comes to looking at molecular drivers. And the thing, as I suggested earlier, is that if we only targeted people that were women and never smokers, we'd miss about 57% of the patients that potentially could have this as an oncogenic driver. So in patients with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer, first and second generation EGFR TKIs are superior to platinum-based chemotherapy doublets. Platinum-based chemotherapy doublets really were the standard of care for more than 15 years, I think, until I had the EGFR as the identified driver. So this study is one of our second generations. This is of afatinib, and you can see that over a cisplatinum-based doublet, almost doubling the progression-free survival. So we have multiple studies looking at several of these targeted therapies that demonstrated similar results. The unfortunate thing is that these oncogenic mutational-driven cancers, once we diagnose and identify it, after the first and second generation TKI, there's the development of clinical resistance to that EGFR TKI, and that typically occurs at about the one-year mark. So as soon as somebody's diagnosed and we begin to treat them, already we need to begin to think about what our second-line treatment is going to be for that patient. Our current practice now is to, in many cases, re-biopsy patients, and that might be either tissue biopsy or it may be liquid biopsy to look at these driver mutation, these mechanisms of resistance. The most common mechanism of resistance for EGFR-driven lung cancer is T790 mutation. That makes up about 60% of those drivers of the mutation. And so that begins to be where we target our development of our next generation of therapies. So osimertinib is a third-generation EGFR inhibitor, and that specifically targets that T790 mutation. And so when we look at progression-free survival and overall survival against standard EGFR TKI, you can see superiority in that third-line TKI inhibitor. So again, we're expanding our palette for what treatment options we have for our patients. So when we're looking at acquired resistance now to third-line therapy, because again, we get a certain length of opportunity to treat patients even with a third line, now we're beginning to look at additional mechanisms of acquired resistance. Again, this requires either additional serum, liquid biopsy, or tissue biopsy to look at it. There are a few mechanisms that actually pop out at us. One is the MET mechanism. It's an acquired resistance. So they didn't have it as a primary driver of their lung cancer, but they're developing it as a secondary.
secondary mechanism. And we also see that, although it looks small in here, we actually do see that that's one of the higher acquired mechanisms of resistance. So in summary, for initial therapy for non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer with EGFR mutations, osimertinib is our first-line therapy, and followed by erlotinib, afatinib, gefitinib, tucatinib. We look for progression at the T790. We test for that. We test for other acquired resistant mechanisms. And again, begin to think about what our next line is. Right now, looking at also combinations of therapy and what is the appropriate sequencing. Some of the discussion now revolves around the thought that maybe we should start with the osimertinib in the first-line setting first, and many practitioners, I think, have actually gone down that path. So now let's look at the ALK mutations. This is an ever-evolving field, as you will hear shortly. Crizotinib was the very first one that was approved. However, it did not really have good penetration in the blood-brain barrier. And brain metastases are one of the most common mechanisms of progression of disease for ALK-driven non-small cell lung cancers. This was followed by second generation, so ceritinib, alectinib, brigatinib, and now we have third generation, lorlatinib, and others that are in clinical trials. So currently, right now, crizotinib, ceritinib, and alectinib are approved in first-line or later therapies, and brigatinib approved in second-line therapy. As of yesterday, the FDA has now granted approval to lorlatinib in second-line and later therapy. So this slide is already outdated as of about 24 hours ago. So it's like we're constantly in this race to keep up with our treatments. So this is just gives you an idea of improvement with our second-line treatment with alectinib over crizotinib. And the reason that there's such a significant improvement with alectinib over crizotinib for the ALK-driven cancers is because there's significant improvement in control in the CNS. So those patients treated with crizotinib have a fourfold increase in CNS progression versus the alectinib. So there is improvement in overall survival given that line of therapy. There are other mutations, so we've got ROS1 gene rearrangements. Crizotinib is now approved in the treatment for those rearrangements, as ceritinib. I'm not sure. I didn't read the FDA approval really, really closely to see if lorlatinib was actually approved in this, but I'm assuming that it actually would have received that approval because it is an ALK and a ROS-targeted TKI. For BRAF, V600E mutation, dabrafenib and trametinib are approved therapies. MET exon 14 makes up about 3% of non-small cell lung cancers, and crizotinib is the approved recommended therapy in that line. RET inhibitors, there are a few. These are just two of the ones that are in trials right now. And there are certainly other targets that are involved in non-small cell lung cancer, such as HER2 and the NTRK fusions. So again, the field continues to grow. This is my attempt at providing a summary of the mutations. The ones that are in bold are those that have approved agents right now. Those that are in just regular text are those that you might be able to consider in off-label or compassionate use in some cases, and some of the ones that are in italics are actually in emerging therapies that are in clinical trials right now. So again, this is not just one disease. Even within the context of lung cancer, within non-small cell lung cancer, there is certainly a huge range of different cancers that we are treating with different targets. So in general, for those that don't have actionable mutations, adenocarcinoma is the first-line treatment in the NCCN guidelines is pembrolizumab, an immune checkpoint inhibitor, or for patients perhaps that don't qualify for just single agent if they don't have an appropriate PD-L1 expression of 50%, they can get combination chemotherapy and immune checkpoint therapy with carbo or cisplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab. Also recommended in the NCCN is carbo, paclitaxel, bevacizumab in an appropriate patient population, along with atezolizumab. In the squamous cell population, pembro is also approved, as is combination chemotherapy and pembrolizumab. And for patients that are not immune checkpoint inhibitor candidates, then chemotherapy doublets really remains the standard of care. In the second line therapy,
again, systemic immune checkpoint therapy. So this is really lays out the foundation for all of our patients that are not don't have a driver mutation that's initially identified. In those patients that do have a driver mutation, however, if they do have progression of disease, they are candidates. If there is not a second or third line TKI that is in the lineup, then they would be candidates for immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy or doublet systemic chemotherapy. And this is just an example of one of the approvals for KEYNOTE-24 for pembrolizumab, which really just did demonstrate in the initial report out in terms of improvement of overall survival over chemotherapy. And this really extended out to the 2 years. This was just an updated analysis that was done by Julie Bramer. And this is what led to the approval. So next lines that we're looking at is, I mentioned, combination TKIs, but we're also looking at, when we look at immune checkpoint therapy, is combinations such as nivolumab and ipilimumab over chemotherapy, and a study that was just published this year by Matt Hellman in the New England Journal demonstrated that there is a significant improvement in progression-free survival as well as duration of response for patients with non-small cell lung cancer treated with a doublet immune checkpoint inhibitor. At this point, it is not yet FDA approved in terms of that combination. So just a really quick summary as far as the immune checkpoint inhibitors that are approved for non-small cell lung cancer. We've got nivolumab in both of the dosing schedules, so whether it's every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks. We've got pembrolizumab in the first line setting and second line setting. There is some consideration for PD-L1 testing. Atezolizumab, and as Beth already explained, the one that's approved for stage 3 is the durvalumab. So now we'll go on to toxicity management.
Yeah, so we wanted to make this more the bulk of the talk and talking about how we manage toxicity. So I'm going to talk about the targeted therapies, and we'll just start off by talking about EGFR inhibitor rash. So we know that this is the most common toxicity we see with EGFR inhibitors. But I do think it's interesting, Marianne, because now with osimertinib being available in the first line setting, we've seen significantly less rash with this drug. And you wouldn't go generally to another first-generation EGFR inhibitor in the second line. So I've seen less rash in my population of patients. But we'll talk about what those percentages are. It tends to be on the face and chest, but it can be on other parts of the body. And it can range anywhere from very mild to pretty severe. It's often described as a papulopustular eruption because it tends to be acne-like in the way that it forms. And why does it happen? We don't necessarily know exactly, but what we do know is the epidermis, that layer underneath of the first kind of layer of your skin, really relies on epidermal growth factor in a large way. So what ends up happening is when you inhibit epidermal growth factor, you're going to have negative effects on that epidermis. And that epidermis is responsible for holding fluid and basically hydrating your skin. So that's why it gets so dehydrated. The epidermis becomes very thin because the EGFR is being inhibited. So you end up with very dry skin, thin, flaky skin, and then we also think there's a recruitment of the immune system, and that's where you get that pustular reaction due to the inhibition of epidermal growth factor. So we think that's generally why it occurs and why we have the symptoms. So this is just a table looking at the different percentages. Now, I put cetuximab and panitumumab in here. They're not approved in lung cancer. Cetuximab sometimes can be used, but doesn't have an FDA approval. But I put some of the incidences in here just to give you an idea that they do vary pretty significantly sometimes between drugs. The pink ones are the more recent ones. As a matter of fact, dacomitinib was just within weeks, has been approved in lung cancer, another EGFR inhibitor. So it's a pretty crowded field. But if you look over in that grade 3-4 incidence column, you can see osimertinib, which is the one that we generally are using first line. It's only 0.5% of people have a severe rash with that. So that probably has the best outcome when we talk about toxicity from rash, and that's been pretty nice, I have to be honest. Now, there is a meta-analysis looking at EGFR rash and clinical benefit. This was published in 2013, so this is pretty much before osimertinib was getting most of its play. But this was generally taking into account the other drugs that were causing significant rash, and rash did play a significant indicator as far as response. So we do know that is true in lung cancer with the EGFR inhibitors. If you have an EGFR mutation, you're taking an EGFR inhibitor, and you get a bad rash, that tends to correlate with response, which was all the more reason that we wanted to make sure that we're treating it well. However, that really doesn't apply with osimertinib, and I want to make that clear, because the osimertinib has such a less amount of rash and basically better results in the first-line setting than those other drugs. So I just want to be clear, even while this does correlate, it doesn't really correlate with the osimertinib as much, because this meta-analysis looked at that before OC was in the first-line setting. So can you do preventative measures? Well, yes, there was a study. Now, this was panitumumab patients, which has a higher rate of grade 3-4 rash than the usual ones that we use. But this did show an improvement in colorectal patients if you preemptively gave them doxycycline and topical hydrocortisone cream. I will say this study, you had to put topical hydrocortisone cream all over your body. So the compliance was iffy on that study, and that was difficult.
And it was a very select population.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of like the tube I would prescribe. Yeah, right. That would get my arm. So this is not overly real world, and I can't say that I've done this with most of my EGFR but patients. What I will say is I was part of a paper that was recently published for osimertinib, and we do not recommend preemptive treatment because the rash is so minimal. That we don't think that there's any need for prevention. So other suggestions, though, for prevention are the obvious. Use creams without dyes or fragrances. Use SPF sunscreen when you're going to be out in the sun, or even if you're not going to be in direct sunlight, but you're going to be out and about, use something like that. Protective clothing. Erlotinib or afatinib are recommended to take on an empty stomach because that's going to give you a more regulated absorption, as opposed with food that would speed up the absorption and give you more significant toxicities. But the other drugs can be taken with or without food and not affect rash. Avoid, obviously, very hot showers and direct sunlight or extreme temperatures. The mask recommendations for treatment state that there's some topicals listed up there. Now, you may not know some of these, and MASC is a multinational organization, so we chose topicals that are available all around the world. Fluocinonide is a higher potency topical steroid, so I wouldn't recommend a whole lot of use of that on the face, but it is topical and can be helpful for the rash. The systemic would be doxycycline or minocycline, so the antibiotics. Patients will ask, well, how long should I remain on them? There is safety data that you can remain on these drugs for a significant period of time, months and months. But a lot of times the rash will wax and wane, so if they're on the antibiotics for a month and then the rash improves, they can cut out the antibiotics and see how the rash is doing. You can use a retinoid, which is recommended there, but I don't usually prescribe that. If it gets to that point, I'm going to refer them to dermatology.
Exactly.
Just some pictures of rash. This is a mild to moderate rash. Patient just has it around her nose and her chin. It was bothersome, but not severe. For her, she was on erlotinib. We continued it and prescribed some topical clindamycin to dry up the pustules some, encourage her to moisturize. This is a patient with a grade 3 rash initially that you can see on the left. And you can see he wasn't shaving anymore. Men, that's how you know it's bad, when they can't even shave their face. So we treated him actually with oral doxycycline and topicals, and you see he did improve. This was only a week later. So he did have improvement with that. So that is something that's reasonable to treat a grade 2 or 3 rash that way. This is a patient with a severe grade 3-4 rash. She claimed she wasn't in the sun, but you can kind of see the sunglasses line. But what I will say about this is she may not have been. What we tend to see is the rash from this drug-induced rash tends to be worse in patients where they've had prior sun exposure. So it looks like she probably had a lot of prior sun exposure there, and the rash. We've also seen this with men who wore like V-neck T-shirts a lot of their life. They're on these EGFR inhibitors, and then they get the rash just in that V area where obviously they've had sun exposure over time. For this patient, we held drug, treated her with topicals, doxycycline, and then we restarted at a lower dose and obviously be sure she's using sunscreen. Has anyone seen trichomegaly? So curling of the eyelashes, this is pretty significant. This is a woman, and she had just trimmed them. So this is usually a longer-term side effect after being on the drugs for many months. So we recommend trimming them carefully, but if they're curling in, really try to consult ophthalmology and see what they might think, because this can certainly develop into blepharitis, conjunctivitis, infections, scratching of the cornea. So just an annoying side effect. Paronychias. So paronychias can be on the fingers or toes. This is inflammation around the nail beds. It is not bacterial usually, though you can culture it. If there's a bacterial component, you can treat it, but generally it's not. It's usually inflammatory due to the inhibition of epidermal growth factor in this area. Usually treatments, you can do diluted vinegar soak, so only a tiny bit of vinegar per water. There's also bleach soaks. Again, it's very, very small amount of bleach to a very large amount of water. I would recommend looking at the Mass Skin Toxicity Study Group paper on this if you want the exact ratios. But again, can culture it, topical steroids, or even cauterization with silver nitrate. But for a lot of these cases, I've sent them to dermatology or podiatry to consider a partial nail avulsion. And that's what it ends up with a lot of times, because you don't necessarily want to hold drug. And that's not something that's going to resolve quickly from holding drug, especially if the patients need the EGFR inhibitors. I will say, as much as I said osimertinib, you know, doesn't cause as much rash, this is something that osimertinib causes just as much, if not more, than the other EGFR inhibitors. So paronychia is a real thing that we still struggle with.
So I think it's worth making sure that you send them to the dermatologist, because the other consideration is that some people wind up holding their drug and you have less compliance with medication adherence when they have these types of really painful side effects. So if they can't get their shoes on, they can't walk, they might stop taking their drugs.
Yeah, loose-fitting shoes or flip-flops are better, but we all know how that goes in the Northeast in the winter, not the shoes of choice. Fissuring and cracking, again, really dry skin can occur from this, so you'd want to use thick moisturizing creams, but really just super gluing these fissures together is the best thing. I know it sounds crazy, but that's actually recommended in our mask paper, is using like a super glue to glue these cracks and fissures together so they don't get infected. Scalp rash can be difficult to manage. This was actually a patient on osimertinib, so while she didn't have much of a rash anywhere else, she did have issues with her scalp and dry scalp. So selenium-based shampoos are moisturizing shampoos, and then there are some prescription shampoos as well. And then just pruritus and cirrhosis. So itching and dry skin can become really bad. This is, again, an osimertinib patient. So antihistamines, topical moisturizers. And then I put a question for aprepitin and pregabalin, which have a little bit of anecdotal data that's been published in looking at this, but I can't say that I've ever used either to treat this. Diarrhea is the second most common side effect in EGFR inhibitors, and I just put incidences up there. Again, varies over the drugs, but if you look at osimertinib, only 2.2% grade 3-4 as opposed to some of the other drugs that are approved now in lung cancer. But incidence-wise, they probably all are around 50 to 60%, other than dacomitinib or afatinib have a higher rate. So management is nothing new there. Loperamide, diphenoxylate atropine, hydration, electrolyte repletion, or dose reductions, which often happens with afatinib. I can say we dose reduce for diarrhea every once in a while, but I don't dose reduce too often for diarrhea with these drugs. Usually it's pretty manageable. So again, my considerations here, side effects can vary from drug to drug, especially the incidence. Dacomitinib was just approved this month. It does have superiority over gefitinib in the first-line setting, but again, there's no head-to-head with osimertinib, which is the drug that we're most commonly using, which also appears to be the least toxic. Afatinib has some post-hoc analysis looking at using 30 milligrams as opposed to 40. 40 is the dose that was approved in the first-line setting. But it appears that the pharmacokinetics are really the same between 30 and 40, and 30 seems to be much better tolerated for this drug if you're using that. So.
And some people will start at 30 and escalate up to
Yeah, you can always do that as well. But I think that was interesting to show that those pharmacokinetics are the same. So moving on to ALK ROS1. This is, not a ton of patients. So ALK is only about maybe 5 to 7%, and ROS1 is 1%. But I chose these drugs individually because these have different side effects. As opposed to the EGFR inhibitors, it's rash, diarrhea. These drugs have different side effects depending on the drug. The one weird thing with crizotinib, and this was the standard of care for years and years and years, so you may still have patients on it, is these visual changes where in the first probably 3 months that they're taking the drug, they have a hard time going from light to dark. If you are at night, especially in a light room, and then you walk into a dark room and you flip the light switch on, the images just trail all back and forth. I've heard a lot of descriptions of it, which seem odd. It is not an injury to your eye or any eye problems. We just recommend not driving at night because that can be difficult when it's dark and you have headlights coming at you. You can see the rest of the warnings. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of these. But this is pneumonitis. So pneumonitis or ILD. So we talked briefly about, and Marianne will talk about this in the immunotherapies. I want to make a clarification. Pneumonitis from the TKIs is much worse usually. This is a permanent discontinuation, whether it's an EGFR inhibitor, an ALK inhibitor, the oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor. This is severe, and it's a permanent discontinuation. It's not like IOs where you can, oh, it's grade 2, treat it and rechallenge. We do not rechallenge with these drugs. This is a patient with a CAT scan before starting crizotinib on the left-hand side, and you can see that only 2 weeks. I put the dates on there so you could see. It was only about 2 or 3 weeks later, significant bilateral pneumonitis from crizotinib. And this was, had to stop and never give it to her again. So it can be severe. And obviously, acute onset shortness of breath needs to be worked up with a CAT scan right away.
So this, some consideration for that, too, is that if you're thinking about then moving on to second-line therapy with an immune checkpoint inhibitor, that would be a significant risk factor for that patient.
Yeah, that's a good point.
As a toxicity.
Ceritinib was the second drug approved. I put these in order of their approval. Ceritinib is the second drug approved, but I can't say that I use it a whole lot anymore in my practice either. The most common adverse events were pretty significant. Those are pretty significant GI toxicities. Now, I will say there is recent data. You can see my bullet point at the bottom to support a significantly lower dose, 450 milligrams daily instead of the 750 on an empty stomach, and there's less GI toxicity with it. But due to the toxicity, this drug didn't get a whole lot of play. Alectinib is the drug that we're generally using in the first-line setting due to superiority that Marianne mentioned earlier. The one thing that's a little bit different about alectinib is so CPK levels can be elevated, and that can also manifest with myalgias, significant myalgias in some patients. So just be aware of it. We do routinely check CPKs on these patients, though sometimes they're elevated and there is no myalgias. So it kind of all depends, but you have to follow your institutional guidelines on how you're going to, if you're going to dose reduce, which I have had to do in the past for this. Brigatinib, I was about to say is the newest one, but as of yesterday, lorlatinib is the newest. But brigatinib was recently approved, I think, in the past year or two. The one good thing about this, I think it's the only one that's one pill once a day. So that's helpful. But the ILD rate, so interstitial lung disease or pneumonitis rate, much higher with this one than the other ones. However, this is one, unlike the rest, that you actually can manage it and retreat and dose reduce as opposed to the other TKI. So this is the only drug that has a higher rate of ILD, but it's usually not as severe, and usually you can dose reduce, treat with prednisone, dose reduce if they recover. So that's why there's a run-in of 90 milligrams daily, and if the patient tolerates that, you go up to 180. But if they develop ILD in that 90 milligram cohort, then you're going to hold drug and dose reduce. And then lorlatinib was approved yesterday. I didn't get a chance to put a slide in the past 24 hours on it. The only thing I'll say about lorlatinib is that it tends to have the same side effects as the other ALK inhibitors, which is a little bit of nausea, a little bit of GI toxicity, a little bit of edema. But the one thing it is specific to it is hypercholesterolemia. So we have seen some elevated cholesterol levels in these patients. So that's one thing we check on study with them as opposed to the other drugs we don't routinely check. So conclusions, alectinib superior to crizotinib in the first-line settings, and the toxicity significantly vary as opposed to the EGFR inhibitors, so you kind of have to know drug to drug. Real quickly, BRAF. BRAF is a thing in lung cancer too, not just you melanoma folks out there. So we have this in lung cancer as well. It's pretty rare, only 1%. But again, the main thing I'll highlight, I have a whole bunch of stuff on there, is the fever. And the fever is weird with this. You know, patients get it. But if you hold drug, and it's high, it's a high fever, 102, 103, I often will do an infectious workup on the first time, but usually it's going to be negative. You just hold drug, usually you can restart them at the same dose, and sometimes you'll get a fever again, and then you hold it and restart them at the same dose. So you don't always have to dose reduce for fever. That's the one thing I'll say about this. Long laundry list here of other drugs with other toxicities, but for the most part, there's a little bit of cardiotoxicity with some of the ALK inhibitors that you may want to check an echo at baseline or even an EKG. But for the most part, you know, these drugs are generally very well tolerated.
Especially the next generation, second and third generations.
Yeah. So conclusions for me, several targeted therapies are approved in lung cancer. They generally have different toxicity profiles, so you have to check the package insert or really be knowledgeable of the drug. There's more and more to come, literally, as we know. Dacomitinib and lorlatinib are just in the past weeks. And most of the toxicities, though, are predicted. So they should be manageable because we should know that they're going to happen and educate patients about them.
Great. Now we're on the fast track and management of toxicities of those immune checkpoint inhibitors, which have become the mainstay for all of us. So as we know, immune checkpoint inhibitors promote T-cell activity, but that activation really cannot be confined to anti-tumor effects alone. So that amplification of the immune system can lead to unrestrained T-cell attack on any organ system. The first key in terms of managing patients is that we want to make sure that we're ruling out any other cause for these toxicities. My colleague, Emily Duffield, and I did a meta-analysis of several of the earlier studies. So this was published about a year and a half ago now, and it's already, I would say, outdated, but looked at several different combinations of therapies and looked at each of the toxicities and looked at the range. This is not, I'm sure you can read this very clearly all the way in the back there, but looked at each of the toxicities to see when was the median onset based on drug, based on combination, and what was that span. And what we know from these therapies is that the median onset is at about 5 to 12 weeks across the checkpoint inhibitors. However, it can occur within days. It can occur even within hours. We've had some cases of reported pneumonitis, acute pneumonitis, or pericarditis within even hours. But they also can occur after months of treatment or even after discontinuation of treatment. It may affect one organ or it may affect multiple organs. And at this time, we don't have any biomarkers to help us identify who, what patient is going to be at risk for which of the organ systems that are going to be affected or in what sequence. And so that's where a lot of the work on looking at adverse immune-mediated adverse events really is going at this time. The incidence and severity is higher in anti-CTLA-4 agents over those with PD-1 or PD-L1 agents. There is some suggestion that there is a dose dependency. We do know that there is also some suggestion that there's a cumulative effect with anti-CTLA-4 agents that we don't tend to see with the anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 agents. And that there is also an increase with the combination of the immune checkpoint inhibitors. One thing I just want to point out here, we're talking about in lung cancer, anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1, but there are several other checkpoints that are currently under investigation. And we're beginning to see in clinical trials, phase one, phase two trials at this point, combinations of using those other checkpoints. And so I'm sure at that point we'll begin to see even another kind of picture of the presentation of these immune checkpoint adverse events. When we look at the treatment-related side effects in terms of combination, I just wanted to point this out. This was also published by Hellman this year in the New England Journal. This is looking at the treatment side effects of combination drug. The darker colors on both sides are grade 1, grade 2. So we can see that most oftentimes the toxicities are fairly well tolerated. And then the lighter colors on each are the ones that experience grade 3, 4 toxicity. So this was combination of nivolumab and ipi, and this is nivolumab as a single agent. And you can see that there is just an increased risk of that treatment-related side effect in the combination therapy. We're going to go to the next one. So we're going to do it by organ system as best we can. We can't cover every single organ system, but in patients with lung cancer, they do experience a slightly higher rate of pneumonitis as an immune-mediated toxicity over some of the other organ diseases that we see. So slightly higher rates than patients with melanoma, renal cell carcinoma, and others that are treated with immune checkpoint inhibitors. Keys to getting patients ready to be on treatment in terms of prevention, smoking cessation is really important. Patients do tolerate treatment and have less risk of pneumonitis if they stop smoking, if they receive their appropriate vaccination. Those that are at risk are those that have received prior chest radiation, those that have COPD, and I should certainly add those that have been on a TKI and have had any experience of pneumonitis. So a drug-induced pneumonitis would increase a patient's risk of developing pneumonitis due to an immune checkpoint inhibitor.
Presentation is typically dyspnea, shortness of breath at rest, a dry, non-productive cough, so any change in their respiratory status, tachypnea, tachycardia. Very infrequently, patients might develop a chest pain, but typically what we'll see is a change in their oxygen requirements. So if it's somebody that's oxygen dependent, they might have to turn up their level of oxygen support. They might have an increased need with any type of exercise or even in the evening. Really easy thing to ask patients to do is, can you walk as far as you used to be able to walk? Can you climb the stairs the way that you used to be able to climb the stairs? Do you need to take more frequent rests in order to accomplish the same task? And then monitoring their oxygen saturation is a really very, very quick and cheap way to monitor their status. Other things on physical exam, measuring heart rate, again, the oxygen saturation, getting a diagnostic imaging. CAT scan is really the standard tool. Some people will do x-rays, but you really can't typically get a good picture of a pneumonitis or the level of pneumonitis or lung involvement in order to grade it by just doing an x-ray. So typically you'll see interstitial infiltrates, ground glass opacities. Important when you're ordering your CAT scans, typically we'll inform the radiologist if they're not familiar with checkpoint inhibitors that we are looking for a drug-induced pneumonitis, or we're trying to make sure that we're ruling out other causes. So is there a risk for pulmonary embolus? Is there a progression of disease? Is there a progression like lymphangitic spread of disease or pneumonia or effusions? So you want to make sure you're really painting that picture for the radiologist so they can give you the best feedback possible. In terms of laboratory assessment, if a patient does have an infectious appearance, then you can continue to do an infectious workup if you're worried about an infectious pneumonia. But typically, these patients don't always have that. For consultation, pulmonary and infectious disease can be very helpful in managing the toxicity. So the important thing what we're doing is we're going to grade the toxicity. So in general standards, if the patient has less than 25% of the lung involved, that's considered a grade 1 or mild. These patients might have very subtle symptoms or maybe not any symptoms at all. They may just have some diagnostic changes that were picked up on their restaging scans. In those cases, we can continue on with immune checkpoint therapy. For grade 2, where there's 25 to 50% of the lung involved or the patients become more symptomatic, the recommendation is to hold the immune checkpoint inhibitor. If the patient is more hemodynamically unstable, we'll begin steroids with methylprednisolone at 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day until the patient has stabilized. Once they've gone to a grade 1 or resolved, then we begin to taper that steroid over a month. For grade 3 to 4, where there's more than 50% of the lung involved, then that's going to be considered grounds for permanent discontinuation. Patients should also have an infectious workup and be followed with a pulmonologist. If a patient does not have recovery of symptoms or improvement in symptoms in 24 to 48 hours, we raise it or escalate the treatment to the next level of immunosuppression. So that would be infliximab at 5 mg per kg. And the second dose can be given in 14 days if that is necessary. Dermatologic toxicities are the second most common. And when you look at melanoma, derm tends to occur more frequently in melanoma and pneumonitis, kind of third in line in terms of the toxicities, but it's a little different in lung. So prevention, just as with the TKIs, sunscreen, moisturizer, instructing patients to wear sunglasses. Risk factors are if they have an underlying dermatologic condition such as psoriasis or eczema. Presentation, oftentimes the first presentation is significant pruritus. Patients might say that they feel like they're crawling out of their skin, even if they don't have any demonstration of a rash. But they then will develop a macular papular rash. If it does progress, patients have progressed to TENS, so toxic epidermal necrolysis or Stevens-Johnson syndrome, such as the patients that are in some of these pictures in the bottom. You want to rule out other causes such as cellulitis, contact dermatitis, allergies, sun exposure, radiation recall, other drug reaction, or maybe it's going to be a flare of that underlying autoimmune disease. Again, physical examination of the skin important. In general, no diagnostic imaging is done. In terms of laboratory, occasionally the rash might be a little bit concerning enough or questionable enough where it's not so clear that it's due to the immune checkpoint inhibitor, in which case the dermatologist can be very helpful in oftentimes biopsying the rash to really clarify the etiology of that rash. Right now, our grading is based on kind of the mass guidelines for grading, and it's really not the best tool to grade a dermatologic toxicity from an immune checkpoint inhibitor. So right now, we use whether the body surface area. So grade 1 is less than 10%, grade 2 is going to be 10 to 30, grade 3, 4 is greater than 30% body surface area. But what I will say is that a rash can be significantly toxic to a patient, and it might only be in a 10 to 15% area of the body, you can actually develop sloughing of the skin, such as suggested of a Steven Johnson's type syndrome. And again, it might be a small body area. So BSA is not the best tool. So you really need to, in combination, look at the severity of the rash or the skin disorder and also the percentage of the body that's involved. But for the tool that we have right now for what we're using, we continue on with the immune checkpoint inhibitor at grade 1 and using topical steroids and moisturizers for grade 2. We would raise to a more higher potency topical steroid plus minus oral prednisone. And grade 3, 4, we would hold the immune checkpoint inhibitor, treat topically and also treat systemically with the methylprednisolone. Some other considerations, again, as I mentioned, a derm consult is quite helpful in helping to identify the etiology and the management. In most cases, these patients, if their rash resolves, we can go on to successfully treat them unless they've had the Steven Johnson syndrome. But it tends to kind of wax and wane through the course of their treatment, and it may not recur at all. Gastrointestinal toxicity, diarrhea, and colitis. The one thing I'd like to point out and just raise awareness in terms of the colitis, colitis does not always mean that a patient has a significant increase in the number of stools that they have per day. Think about our lung cancer patients that might be on high doses of opioids. So they might have chronic constipation. And so an onset of colitis for them might just mean that they're now going every other day or maybe just once a day. But if it's associated with abdominal cramping, discomfort, even spasm or pain, or associated nausea, that could be what colitis looks like for that patient. We know in the preliminary studies, actually, that the diarrhea, unfortunately, was kind of underreported in terms of its significance. So, again, monitoring the volume is going to be important. If it's less than 4, we're still using the old criteria, which is not immune-related, but for now, that's what we have. So less than 4 stools per day, consider holding the immune checkpoint inhibitor, treating with loperamide. If it's moderate, we're going to hold, initiate steroids. If they're refractory, they will start on a secondary immunosuppressant agent. Grade 3, this is one thing that's a little different. So some of the other grade 3s, we permanently discontinue. For GI toxicity, we hold and consider resuming if there's resolution of symptoms. Grade 4, it's permanently continuing and starting steroids. GI consult can be extremely helpful in helping to manage patients. Endocrine toxicities, my favorite thing to talk about. The thyroid can be significantly affected. Patients have vague symptoms, fatigue, sluggishness, weight loss, or weight gain. Many patients may present with asymptomatic hypothyroid syndrome. So if a TSH is less than 10, we just continue to monitor their thyroid functions. They might not need supplementation. If their TSH is greater than 10, we continue, but we introduce levothyroxine. And again, in most of these cases, what we're doing is targeting we want to get our level to a T4 of mid-range. That's really the lab that you're chasing. Central hypothyroidism is a secondary hypothyroidism due to dysfunction of the pituitary. We can continue the immune checkpoint inhibitor after we treat hypophysitis. Additional labs really are around managing or assessing the hypophysitis in these cases. You can see that in most cases, we don't have to discontinue the immune checkpoint inhibitor because we're going to manage with hormone replacement. Adrenal insufficiency is infrequent, but it can be life-threatening if it's not identified correctly. So monitoring the appropriate lab values to assess for adrenal function is important, including doing a morning cortisol stimulation test. the one key to adrenal insufficiency is that if you successfully manage these patients with hormone replacement, they can successfully go on to re-challenge on the immune checkpoint inhibitor. The key is that you want to start the corticosteroid hormone replacement prior to any other hormone replacement, so prior to the initiation of levothyroxine replacement, because you also, otherwise you would you want to make sure you're avoiding adrenal crisis. So typically patients will need hydrocortisone or prednisone in the dosing that's going to mimic natural secretion. So higher dose in the morning and lower dose in the evening, as well as fluticortisone replacement. Hypophysitis, again, we're going to introduce the hormone replacement as necessary depending on the organ dysfunction that the patient is exhibiting. If you have successful treatment, you can go on to re-challenge these patients. There are many other organ systems that can be involved. I wish we had time to go through every single one of them. But in most cases, hepatic, renal, in most of those cases, they tend to be slight elevations in the lab function. And so you want to make sure you're assessing, holding hepatotoxic drugs, limiting nephrotoxic drugs, managing that toxicity. If they are in lower grades, we can usually go on to successfully re-challenge. Goals, refractory IRAEs can occur. So the goal, if you have no improvement in the toxicity after you've initiated methylprednisolone therapy, a secondary immunosuppressant agent might be necessary. Infliximab is the most common. It's contraindicated in patients that have hepatic involvement or hepatitis. It can reactivate HPV. And also TB, so you want to make sure you test for TB. It does require pre-authorization, which can be a lengthy process in some cases. Mycophenolate is a second immunosuppressant agent that might be necessary. Other things that have been used are things like cyclosporin, IVIG, particularly in the neurotoxicities that have developed. So guiding principles, corticosteroids really are the mainstay of treatment for these patients. Use of this corticosteroids has not been shown to reduce anti-tumor effect, and that's important when we're educating our patients. Sometimes steroid taper might require more than 4 weeks, so keep that in mind. I've got a patient that had pneumonitis that has actually been on about a year of a steroid taper. We just can't get him any lower than 12 milligrams per day of prednisone. We need to, if they're going to be on long-term steroid prophylaxis against pneumocystis and also fungal infections is going to be important, proton pump inhibitor to prevent gastritis. And then just keep in mind if they're on long-term steroid use, prevention of osteoporosis. I've already talked about the infliximab risks. Just keep in mind also as there are more and more approvals for immune checkpoint inhibitors that there are special considerations for patients that have either had either an organ transplant in the past or stem cell transplant or maybe going to that in the future, that there is a risk of losing graft with stimulation of the immune system with T cell activity, so that you've got to go down that path really cautiously. There are several resources that are available to help support you in managing your patients. Right now, the NCCN, CITC, and ASCO have really had a significant coordination of efforts in developing guidelines that are free and accessible to you. AIM with immunotherapy was just launched 2 weeks ago, and all of these organizations are here, and you can get that information while you're here, many of which are available online to help support you in following algorithms for managing these toxicities and keeping your patients safely on therapy.
And Marianne was the only nurse on the NCCN guideline panel for the management of immune-related toxicities.